Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and families and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me from Washington, D.C., I welcome Rahsaan Burroughs, college counselor at CollegeWise, the nation's largest college counseling organization. Rahsaan is a former associate director of admissions and liaison to the Department of Athletics at the George Washington University. Rahsaan, I welcome you to 411 Team.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
What did you learn from your college experiences, which aids you in advising young folks today as far as the college application process?
Sure. So my first foray into the admissions world was actually as an admissions intern my senior year at the College of William & Mary. So I spent a good amount of months reading files and planning open house programs and doing informational sessions and then meeting the students at our open houses whose files I had read. And it was a really neat introduction to the world of admissions. So during my time at GW, I was able to do a lot of different parts of the admissions process, from your traditional recruitment on the road, visiting schools and doing programs with families and students, on-campus programming and visits, interviews, and of course, reading several 1,000, I think it's 17,000 applications roughly in my time there as well. So I've been able to really see what goes into the deliberation of deciding who you want to invite to be a student on your campus. And for me, it was working with students and meeting with students out on the road and seeing the possibilities that they could bring to campus that I most enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So I jumped the desk, as we called it, to start working more directly with students and families and helping them find their homes, their college homes, across, regardless of sort of what their major levels of interest are and even the types of schools that they're interested in.
Well, then let's explore just getting into college, because planning for college can be, as I mentioned, one of the most exciting times in a young person's life. They're moving to the next level, a whole novel phase of life. But that college admission process can be overwhelming. It can be tiring and confusing and exhilarating and exhausting all in one breath. On the average, when do students formally start the process?
Let's see. Well, the average. Well, I would love to say that everyone is the average, but there are some who come to the process a bit later than others. Mm-hmm. I think the beginning of junior year is a good time to start focusing on the college process, and that doesn't mean they're deciding on their complete and total college list early, but it is when you are starting to potentially visit some campuses, to attend some informational sessions at your school when colleges are coming through doing visits, or in your area doing receptions or group travel. It's when you are able to start with big picture items like how far away from home do I want to go to school? Do I like large campuses or small campuses? So answering some of those questions to then inform your college list as you start looking at specific schools and or specific types of schools, I should say. If you start that early, once the spring comes around and you've got a testing profile with the SAT or the ACT coming into play, you can see kind of where, how balanced your list is. Mm-hmm. And then so hopefully you're going into the summer with an idea of your almost final college list, really to then inform, come when the Common App opens and were writing personal statements and mm-hmm. supplemental essays and such, so that, you know, if you start early, you have the luxury of time and to be thoughtful about the process. So, you know, students who are still coming into the process this late, who really are sort of, you know, senior year hits them like a ton of bricks in September, and then the reality that it's time to apply is there. Mm-hmm. They just have to get really good at multitasking, because they don't have as much time to get done what they, you know, would have been able to get done had they started sooner. But, you know, for the students who sort of put their heads down and get to work, and who are good at multitasking, they can, you know, arrive at the holidays with their applications intact and ready to submit as well.
And you may have touched on this or alluded to it. It's always the whole college admission process is always viewed as just a very overwhelming, stressful time. And can you address some of the stresses and the pressures that the students and the parents experience, and maybe suggestions as to how to avoid it? Because college application time does not really have to be overwhelmingly stressful, overwhelmingly pressured, feeling like you're being pulled in a number of different directions. Would you agree?
I agree. And there are both, I would say, external pressures and then internal pressures. External pressures on some level would be parents trying to keep up with the Joneses. And, you know, you're hearing at dinner parties and such where other people's kids are applying, or about summer programs that students have done. And then maybe, should we have done that? And should we take the SAT or ACT one more time? And, you know, I heard, we get that a lot. I heard from a friend of a friend that ... And so some of that stress that people, I guess, can import to the process. And then students as well, you know, there's a bit of frenzy with their peers and, you know, what they're going through, and, you know, should I apply there? This school seems really popular, and comparing themselves to their peers, again, external pressures. And then internal pressures, you know, if students have worked hard, and over time, or even if they started slow and they've, done better over time so that they are still improving, there are the pressures to, you know, to achieve academically, to quote unquote, not let people down. Again, things that these are a little more external, but taking that on. And then, you know, the internal pressures that can come from what I call unforced error, starting a great college essay and then letting perfection be the enemy of good, and obsessing over a line or a title when it's sort of you're losing the forest for the trees. And then, you know, you're delayed in getting that done, so you don't start on your supplements in time. So then instead of you having 8 weeks to write supplements, you now have 5 weeks to write supplements, and maybe you're testing again in the fall. So there are some ways that you're compiling the pressure if you don't sort of like lay things out and kind of work through it piece by piece. So those can be some of the internal pressures that come to bear on the process as well.
Well, one of the things you touched on, you were saying the ACT and the SAT. How many times do you recommend a student take it? Does it matter? Does it get to a certain point where, okay, you've taken it enough, let's just stop? Because I've heard students taking it 3 and 4 times.
Yep, and it depends on the students. I have my opinions at a certain point, and particularly how you have done from test beating to test beating. You know, if your score is not really moving within a certain margin of errors between one sitting to another, then that's one where it's like, okay, I think you've basically landed where about you're going to land. So it's like, you know, at my point, I say make your peace with your score and then stop giving the testing agencies their money. But then I have other students who will say, you know, they want to make sure that they have done everything that they could do. So they then end up doing a third or fourth seating for a particular exam. And that's one where it's like, you know, I don't always agree, but if at the end of the day, you'll be able to sleep better knowing you did everything in your power, potentially, then that's a family call. That's not my call.
Okay. How effective are the test prep courses for the ACT and the SAT?
Test prep courses, and they're even in addition to, you know, formalized tutors and courses, there are a lot of free resources mm-hmm. out there. And if a student is pretty well directed and independently directed, they can do just fine with their own free resources. Part of what test prep does is it coaches you not just on content, but on pacing, anxiety management. That's a lot of what this process is about with testing, particularly for some students. And then even, you know, where to spend the majority of your time. If you're within a certain section and the section increases in difficulty from question 1 through, say, question 15, then spend more of your time on questions 1 through 10. If, you know, you're, and then pick your favorite number on the rest of the section. So they can help with some tips and tricks like that. Mm-hmm. But again, the pacing, the anxiety management, the practice test, that it's just sheer getting used to taking the test and pacing yourself. That can be a benefit from, you know, test preparation. But like I said, if a student is very self-directed, I've seen some students have very good success just putting themselves on a schedule and, you know, blocking out the 4 hours on a Saturday, silencing their phone, doing a practice test, you know, every few weeks to get themselves in a position where they felt comfortable, more comfortable in taking some tests.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that, particularly the fact that there are avenues that a student can pursue getting the test prep information without having to pay a lot of money for them, that there are, you know, applications that one can receive. I think that's beneficial because taking all these test prep can add up financially to a significant amount of money. You're tuned into 411 Teen. This hour we are looking at getting into college, college admission, and we're also going to talk about financial aid support. What's the 411? If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I am talking via phone with Rahsaan Burroughs. Rahsaan is a counselor with CollegeWise. He deals with the trials and tribulations of college admission involving that whole roller coaster of emotional highs and lows throughout the whole painful process. What are some of the common mistakes that you find that students make as far as the application is concerned?
As far as the overall process mm-hmm. is concerned, and then specifically with some applications, one thing that can haunt a student is sort of not having a balanced college list.
Okay. So
some schools in our country, and then even internationally, are going to be reach schools for every single student who applies. You know, schools south of a 14 to 9 to 5% admit rate, in some cases, are some people call them lottery schools even. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some students sort of try to take an approach where more is more. So they've applied to more schools like that. And therefore, when decisions have come back, they've limited how many potential options they have after that. So a big one is not having a balanced mm-hmm. college list.
Okay.
And then overall, and we'll talk about financial aid, and part of that is financial aid safety in a way. So making sure your list is also balanced in terms of how much is potentially coming out of pocket for the family. And then there are, again, unforced errors, things down to, and I would see this as a reader, careless mistakes or, you know, not giving an essay a final edit or grammar scrub, typos within an activities list or answering supplements and inserting the wrong school to your Y NYU essay and then writing, cutting and pasting in your YBU essay. things like that mm-hmm. that are going to, you know, a reader who's trying to assess who you are and get a snapshot as of someone that they're bringing to campus, those sort of things just put up little flags as they're reading. So, you know, students then ending up not putting their best foot forward mm-hmm. in their application. And then on one level, students trying to overproduce themselves, or I would say family trying to overproduce a student. A college essay that has had one too many adults in it, so it no longer sounds like a 17-year-old. Uh-huh. You're trying to make things more than they're not so that you're not really getting an authentic voice in an application. And that's in part what readers are looking for. Of course, they want to know, academically speaking, if you can do the work, but they also want to know who are they inviting to campus. And so mm-hmm. when you sort of scrub the personality out of an application because you're trying to sound as impressive as possible, you no longer sound like a kid, mm-hmm. Like a 17 right. or 18-year-old that I'm excited to meet on campus. So that can be potentially one overproducing an applicant or an application.
You know, often I've heard that colleges do not admit students, that they admit applications. Would you respond to that and react to that? What's your take on it?
Sure. Well, let's see. I think enrollment managers are tasked with bringing in a class. So, you know, I hear often some anxiety around, you know, which activities should he be taking to round out his activities? Does she need more leadership? Should he be doing community service? Because there's this sort of myth of the well-rounded student. And, you need a well-rounded class in the end. So that means a lot of lopsided students in there as well. You know, if someone is working part-time 20-some-odd hours a week, I understand as a reader that there's not a whole lot of space for other activities. And that is definitely something that they are dedicated to that is in their non-studying hours. Someone who is in theater or in mm-hmm. dance for upwards of 20 hours a week, you know, again, I would understand that that's still someone that can contribute to a well-rounded class. So, admissions readers, even at your most selective institutions, you know, are looking for students who, by whatever factors they determine, and most of that is actually your high school performance and the quality of the level of work that you've produced and how much you've challenged yourself given where you are. Colleges are definitely looking at that primarily. But even at the most elite colleges, they want to know, again, like, you're not just a brain walking around campus. Mm-hmm. You're someone who's hopefully contributing to the student experience in your own way. So they really are looking for those students who, given student A and B, if student B also then seems, as one of my deans used to say, normal, I'm going to go with the normal kid mm-hmm. because they have everything else, and I have a better sense of who they are, having read their application. So, you know, just wanting to make sure you're still admitting students to a community. So, what you want more than just a brain or a polished essay.
What roles can parents play in this whole process of when sure, they're, yeah.
I think students should very much be in the driver's seat mm-hmm. for the process. Parents most definitely are clearly stakeholders, since the money will be coming from them. But cheering from the sidelines and supporting their students and their decisions you know, coaching them in times when they are down or feeling stressed, and being a voice to bounce things off of, I think is a great role. But the students who tend to move through the process the most smoothly are students who've taken ownership of the process. And so, and part of that is giving the students leeway to take ownership of the process. You know, I would, you know, when I was in admissions, I would, you know, meet families or take phone calls, and, you know, it would be a parent saying, you know, we are very excited to come to attend in the fall. And it's like, well, only one of you is attending in the fall, so that should probably be the person I'm talking to on the phone. So, yeah, you know, like I said, clear stakeholders in the process, but just wanting to make sure, not so much so that the student isn't taking ownership of it.
In the college selection process for application, share some of the important components or variables that play in identifying the right school. I mean, does one go to a community college? Does one go to a four-year college? Do they do online school? Given we know that finances are important, but so what are some of the other variables one must consider?
Yeah, so it somewhat depends on, well, it very much depends family to family, but then also student to student. Like I've seen some students who really benefited from a gap year. You know, they had whatever success they had in high school, but really felt like they weren't ready. And so they've gone off for a year to, you know, I've seen students go off to Israel for a year, students who've traveled, who've gotten involved in service. For the year, and they've come back much more focused and ready to take on the four-year college process. For some other students and families, that is, you know, start at a local community college that has articulation agreements to the flagship schools in the state. So therefore, you know, go and do well at a lower price point, and then there are cases where then there is then guaranteed admission into the flagship institution. And, you know, for some students who do you know, what they want to get done in life, they can get done with an associate's degree. So there's no one path for all students. And so it is kind of, again, family by family and even student by student within a certain family.
Statistics indicate that undergraduates apply more for federal aid than any other group. I think it was 65% of the high school seniors filled out the free application for federal students aid, that FAFSA. What is the best way to approach the FAFSA? And when I say that, I mean, and I, excuse me, but I was saying, because some colleges, even if you are not looking for financial aid, loans, if you're looking for scholarships, you still have to do it. I know that some colleges require it no matter what.
True. So the a vast majority of students will end up filling out the FAFSA. And part of that is that we recommend, you know, at the margin, families often don't think they would qualify for money at any school, and that's not necessarily the case. So there are, you know, the FAFSA can be a tricky document. There are many great tools out there for families to use while they are literally walking through the FAFSA together that will ask, you know, ask you specific questions as you're filling out each section to make sure that it is, you're submitting as error-free of a document online or even on paper still as you can. So it is one that is definitely to take the help where it comes as you're filling it out.
Okay. For the listening audience, just what is it? Share with us what it is. How long does it take to fill out that kind of information? Because I know that alone can be stifling for some students.
Sure. Well, the FAFSA is a federal form, and it is what many schools will use to determine the estimated family contribution. And so there is data going in that then comes out at the end for what a family could, in air quotes, pay for their a part of their education. And it can take a while to get through, particularly if there are a lot of extenuating circumstances within a certain family.
For example, give us a
situation where the parents may be divorced and you split time between, you know, parent A and parent B, and then answering the question, then who is the custodial parent when you're filling out the forms? And so it can get, you know, is there another, say, you know, I've had families where a grandparent is now being taken care of by the initial family unit. So then how does that play in? So those sort of things can sort of add more sort of if-then clauses to you filling out the form. So it is one that is that one that sort of needs some focused time to fill out, and may not be one of those things where you can do it clearly in one sitting. What I do for even families currently, like juniors, who are kind of sitting at a safe distance from the financial aid process, is to sort of give them documents to say sort of, here are some things that you need to be thinking of that you're going to be responsible for, so that the parents can start doing their homework now while the students are starting to do their college search homework. So it is important to note the FAFSA in many ways, because it is federal, and the financial aid process will vary from university to university. And depending on their financial aid budget and ultimately their endowment and how much they can offer in financial aid, the process will be different from school to school. But there is a federal methodology, and then some schools will also use their institutional methodology, where you start bringing in additional forms like the CSS profile that some schools will also use. And the answer for many financial aid questions, because they are school by school, is to, you know, ask the financial aid of the school that you're interested in, of a school that you're interested in, to make sure, you know, what their deadlines are. Sometimes the forms are due at the same time. Sometimes the forms have to chase each other, basically, based on when you are applying. So you wanting to make sure that you're giving yourself the best opportunity to receive aid by meeting priority deadlines and such. So, you know, a few different ways, but then the FAFSA comes into play, I guess, in, as part of that formula, that estimated family contribution.
Well, how is it completed? I mean, can a student go online? Is there a paper? Can you do it on the phone? What else is it? I guess there maybe a mobile app might be one. Or can you have your counselor assist you? Just how is it completed? Or does it matter? Is there an advantage to one way or the other?
Sure. Well, there are most definitely ways to kind of practice and to see what comes of it. The formulas get a bit tricky, so I wish it was as easy as, you know, A plus B plus D, here's your answer. But there are some ways to very much guesstimate. The FAFSA forecaster was one of my favorites, to, again, where you're inputting kind of live information. If you're looking school by school, every university has a net price calculator, which then again gives you for that particular school and the way that they make financial aid decisions. Here is an estimate based on the information you've put in today of what you might receive or what that net cost of that school would be when you look at cost of attendance and estimated family contribution. So definitely, some sort of cost estimators out there to force families to be able to practice and to see again which questions they need to be able to answer to then get a guesstimate on the forms.
Okay, so then you can go to either, I guess, modality you want, whether you want to do it online or you want to do the paper form, or is there even a I think I read there was a mobile app for it now.
There is a mobile app now. There's an app for everything, right?
Right.
So there is a mobile app. In fact, My Student Aid is the name of the mobile app.
Uh-huh.
So it is a far cry from when I applied to college, when we were using paper and word processors and things to fill out forms. But it is, you know, there are, you know, FAFSA.ed.gov with also sort of tutorial to walk a family through, and, you know, a lot of great, again, online resources to literally be able to read through as you're working your way through the FAFSA. So there's, the good news is there is help out there.
Now, one application is all you need to do, no matter for the multitude of schools you may apply to, right?
Well, one FAFSA, mm-hmm. and then potentially one CSS profile.
Okay. And so that, and that then goes to all the schools that one has applied.
Yep, as long as you're making sure when you fill out the FAFSA that you're selecting which schools you want it sent to.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with the CSS profile. And so you would not be, depending on that particular school, your financial aid application, if you were applying, wouldn't be complete until they'd received all the forms.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Did you know nearly 11.5 million students received federal student aid for the 2016-2017 academic year? Rasan, who is this FAFSA for? And I say who, I mean, is it for a student who is independent or a student who is dependent? How do you make that distinction? And we'll go from there.
Sure. So it's for any domestic student who is looking for federal dollars to help pay for college. So that can include clearly dependent students, some independent students. And again, there are many if-thans that mm-hmm. go into effect in terms of determining those things. But again, it's for a tool that universities can then use to determine your estimated family contribution when they are looking to, based on what they have, for the population of students that they admit, it gives them a tool to say within our formula to come up with an aid package. We've got this federal number, which again is a should in air quotes, be able to pay. And then a university can then take that into account and lay on their own dollars to then help come out with an eventual financial aid full package for those students that they want to admit. So it's for any student who wants to be in the conversation. So you have to have it in order for a school to be able to use it for need-based aid. That's different than merit aid.
Mm-hmm.
But if you you don't have it in or you turn them in late, you know, schools do their awarding of funds based on their priority deadline.
Okay.
You know, making sure that you're getting it done and getting it in time is sort of an important piece of the puzzle to being in the conversation for a school to be able to try to put the package together for you.
I'd like to explore, and I know it varies dependent on the school, but I'd like to explore more the independent and dependent student, if you can. I know it's going to probably be a general exploration or examination of what it is, but I've had several questions of asking you to talk about independent versus dependent student.
Sure. So we started at sort of who is, even when you're talking about custodial parents, head of household, start there.
Okay.
And you're saying who all is in the house and who is responsible for paying for the money, paying the money for college. There are, unfortunately, in some ways, if a parent just doesn't want to pay or has said, I'm not contributing to your college, but unfortunately doesn't make a student independent. So there are, again, ways that it's like, if all of these questions are no, and no one is claiming you as a dependent in tax purposes, or you can show the legal documentation that you are then taking on the custodial role yourself, then that's more easily a student who's able to show their independent or their independent status in applying for aid.
I asked that because I had a particular student who posed a situation. They resided in the home with the parents, but they said the parents did not contribute to their daily existence. They worked. They paid for everything in school. Their parents were not willing to share any financial information and made it very clear to the student that if they wanted to go to school, fine, but they had to go on their own. And so that was really the basis for why I asked you to elaborate. I've had several students who've been in that situation and are in that situation. So that's why I ask you.
Oh, yeah, and that is a great time in an individual case to contact a school of interest in directly.
Okay.
To pose the question to the financial aid officers, because then they will be able to say, within the universe that we live in here on this campus, here is what we need from you to be able to prove that. And easier at some campuses than others. But that is a great time when it's for you or someone who's advocating for you, like a college counselor on some level, but the student to contact the schools directly, to then see, here is my situation. And then you're not just a name on a screen. You're a personality to the office, but they would be the best to say, for this particular campus, here is what we need from you. We hear you. We understand where you're coming from. Here is what we need from you to be able to then be independent within our pool.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very helpful. As far as loans, now FAFSA will give a number that identifies how much you are eligible for, and the loan may be either subsidized or unsubsidized. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. Distinguish the two, please.
So let's see. I have to go to
The subsidized is the one that one would prefer to have as opposed to the unsubsidized, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to get my wording correct.
Okay.
So is there a, can we pause and re-ask the question?
Oh, sure.
I don't want to misquote.
Okay.
Pulling up my.
That's okay. In the process of while you're doing that, can you share or make a distinction between then grants and loans? How do they differ? If you get a grant, you don't have to pay it back. Whereas a loan, depending on what type of loan you get, you do have to pay the loan back. Is that correct? Or can you elaborate on that one for me?
Sure. So grants are free money. We love grants. That may come in a variety of forms. If it's coming from the FAFSA, that is, those are dollars that a student or a family don't have to repay. And then the loan of any sort are definitely going to be dollars that a student will have to repay. however they are structured. So grant money could come from the federal government, and then there may be grant money that could come from a university that are also dollars that a family will not pay back.
Okay. Now, the Pell Grant would be the one that's from the federal government, correct?
Correct.
Now, and there is a TEACH grant. I'm just not familiar with that. Would you share? Can you share with us what the TEACH grant is?
The TEACH grant is a new one for me as well.
Okay. Yeah. All right. But I guess they can find out about these grants. Is there a particular resource that you would recommend to students or parents? Both?
Yes.
So, okay.
So from the Department of Ed, and they're from the studentaid.ed.gov.
Okay.
Would be a way to get the sort of the letter of the law and what the different things are. I do have the official definition of unsubsidized
sure.
versus subsidized
okay.
loan.
Sure. Would you share that with us?
Sure. So the big difference is that, of course, they're both based in need, but subsidized loans, interest does not accrue while you're in college.
Okay.
And the interest is paid for by the government.
So with the unsubsidized loan, the interest, I guess the moment you get the money itself, the loan, the interest starts to accrue. Is that correct? I'm just want to make sure I have it right. Okay.
Yes, correct.
It starts. But with the subsidized federal student loan, the interest does not accrue until you leave college. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now, is there a difference in rates? Because I always thought that the interest with the subsidized federal student loans, usually that the interest was lower, and that was one of the reasons that it was preferred. Again, you correct me. I don't know.
Correct.
That is correct.
Yeah, okay. And the subsidized, and then I misspoke, the subsidized are based on need. The unsubsidized are not based on need.
Okay.
And then that is one distinction between why the federal government then is helping to subsidize the loans by paying those interest rates, because it's much more based in a family's need.
Okay. Now, what about scholarships? Suggestions to students on how to secure scholarships, resources, where to go to look for scholarships, because I know there's scholarships. They're coming from all different bases. They may be scholarships based on your interest or your major or where you live or your ethnic background. I mean, there are all types of scholarships I am aware of, but would you share that with us, please?
Sure. So there are many search engines for scholarships, and even if you just type in scholarship for college, that's an easy way to go about it. There are national scholarships, regional scholarships, local scholarships, even which could be $1,000 here from a federal credit union that your parents might be a member of, or $500 here that is linked to a company that your parent works for. So there are some good student scholarship search.com is a good place to start. And the College Board Bright Futures, that's another good search engine for scholarships. And even to say, based on talent, or, I'm somebody who likes the arts. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm applying for a scholarship or a major in the arts, but I'm someone who hears an organization that says we're looking for students who really enjoy the arts and are someday going to be patron of the arts, and we want to help them through college. So many different parts of your personality or what you bring to the table could help you qualify for different types of scholarships. And those are scholarships that are not necessarily attached to the institution that you eventually attend. There may be merit awards that come from a particular school that are dollars to reward students within their own pool for what they've done over the course of their years in high school, and a way to try to attract them, entice them to campus, as well as contribute to need if there is some need for a particular family. So there are scholarships out there that are independent of an institution, and scholarships that are connected specifically to specific universities.
Well, in these last few minutes, there are a couple of things that we would be remiss if we did not address. And one is that whole credit card debt. You know, students are plagued with credit cards. Take this one, have a Visa, have that. What do you recommend? How do you advise they handle that? Because so often they will find themselves caught up when they get ready to graduate, caught up in a lot of bills that are credit card bills. I've seen students using credit cards to finance school, to finance their tuition, to finance, you know, some aspect of their attending college.
So, and those, I would say some of those conversations begin at home in terms of conversation about what the college list looks like and how much we are, how much is coming out of pocket potentially. Mm-hmm. So you can, on the data in side of things, address some of those things. I know college campuses are ripe for credit card companies signing students up. And it, you kind of your first night out with a date, or your first, you know, night out with this, and you sort of like $50 here, $100 here and such, that you can accrue that debt. You know, hopefully you are not in a position, where you are literally filling in the gaps with a credit card payment, because then that is something that, you know, stays with you. That's one of the first hard lessons of adulthood. That debt is yours, not your parents, and then comes back to weigh on your own credit rating down the road, which then can impede you in many other ways. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, again, those conversations are starting early. And again, with, you know, family to family, just with like, what are we willing to cost? What are you going to be doing after you finish this journey? And then, you know, what does it look like you'll be making? If you are, you know, someone who's off to, say, New York City to become a starving artist, your starting salary is going to look a lot different than a student who's recruited during college mm-hmm. to work for a firm. So just making sure you have an idea of sort of data in the beginning and then data out in terms of where you see yourself going and what you may, the ballpark of what you might be making. And then so hopefully you're not going into the experience setting yourself to be sort of behind the eight ball.
In this last minute and a half, one issue I'd like to have you address is the ability to adapt and adjust. Because the pressures and the changes that both the teens and the parents endure, success is dependent upon both of them being able to adapt and adjust to their new environment and their new dictates. Would you say, do you have any closing remarks on adapting? Because they're in a new environment. Their expectations are different. Their time management is different.
Sure. Well, this is, there's a bit of resiliency that's required. And, you know, I say this being a card-carrying Gen Xer and a former latchkey kid whose sort of existence was, you know, very different than some students in the current generation. But just on one level, you know, when you're, it can be small things that throw you off when you're in a new environment, like not getting along with your roommate. Mm-hmm. But being able to then have that conversation or without letting it fester to the point where, you know, several weeks down the road, you're in a toxic environment internally, because of, you know, not just reaching out to have a conversation. And so, adapting, to a campus and knowing that everybody, every freshman is new, when you start off on day one.
I thank you so much for all the information that you have shared. Much appreciation. And to my listening audience, thanks for the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.